Mr. Stanton?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, my name is David Stanton, I'm Chief of the Attorney Department, District Attorney's Office, trial counsel in the case of State versus Humane and Lying Glass, two brothers that were alleged and convicted ultimately in a trial of killing their sister's husband, and I'm here to defend the state's attorney general.
Thank you. For the record, this is case number 56042, Jermaine Brass, appellant versus State of Nevada, respondent. Mr. Warren, and if you wish to reserve any time, let us know how much.
May it please the court, Christopher Warren on behalf of Jermaine Brass. Jermaine Brass's conviction should be overturned for several reasons. First and foremost, I would address the severance issue. Defense counsel raised severance prior to trial and throughout the trial in this particular case. The real issue that developed was antagonistic defenses. Jermaine Brass, his argument was that he was not present. He essentially, the argument of counsel, trial counsel, was he was innocent, was not present, had no involvement, versus Ronnie Brass, whose essential defense was, I was present, I just was merely present. I had no knowledge that a shooting was going to occur. I wasn't involved in the shooting, and therefore I should not be found guilty. Obviously, that puts a situation like Chartier, where this court addressed antagonistic defenses and considered whether they could be mutually exclusive. Here, the antagonistic defenses put the situation in such that a jury could not find both of these individuals not guilty. They had to elect between one of the theories of defense. Here, it was obvious that they believed Ronnie, that he was there, and then that Jermaine was there. Now, what the state did is they introduced portions of statements that Ronnie Brass made that clearly implicated Jermaine Brass. When I say that, what they did is they introduced statements in violation of Bruton and this court's decision in Carl Martin and Duxworth, wherein Ronnie Brass was saying he was present, we knocked on the door. The detective was asked, and was asked by co-defendant's counsel, about what did Ronnie Brass admit to? Well, Ronnie Brass admitted that he was there, he admitted that we were there, and he finally was asked, did he tell you who the shooter was? And the detective said yes, reluctantly. He said who the shooter was, but it was very hard for him. Now, Ronnie Brass and Jermaine Brass are sitting there together. Obviously, defense counsel for Jermaine Brass would stand up and say to the detective, so he implicated somebody else, if in fact the person he'd implicated was not Jermaine Brass. Placing the blanks into the slots, it would be obvious that a jury would say that Ronnie Brass had essentially said his brother was the shooter. And in fact, juror number four wrote a note to the court saying, did Ronnie Brass confirm or deny Jermaine being there that night? Now, that is indicative of the fact that it became apparent that Ronnie Brass was implicating Jermaine Brass. Now, also in this particular case, you had Ronnie Brass, the co-defendant, being represented by one of the most skilled murder attorneys in our system. David Sheik was very clever. He was doing his job, but he was very clever in bringing out portions through the detective and of Ronnie Brass's statement, which clearly implicated Jermaine Brass. For example, Mr. Sheik asked the detective, did Ronnie Brass say that after the shooting, the individuals or Jermaine Brass went to a car, or that the shooter went to a car that was known to the shooter? Then it came out that the car was owned by Jermaine Brass's girlfriend. So it was painfully obvious what had happened here. Now, in Duxworth and Martin, what Judge Lohr did is she precluded the statements of the co-defendant from actually mentioning the co-defendant Martin. So Duxworth's girlfriend testified, and when she did, the blanks were left out of who she was saying Duxworth confessed he was present at the murder with. This court said that it became obvious to anybody that that person is Carl Martin. That's the exact scenario that occurred here. Now, this is subject to a harmless error analysis, And in Martin, the court considered that there was just circumstantial evidence against Martin. Here, that's exactly the case. What was the evidence against Jermaine Brass? Well, there was a fingerprint on his sister's door, but his sister said the shooter did not touch the door, and there had been a previous burglary of which Jermaine was convicted. So easily, he could have touched the door at a prior time. Additionally, his sister said that the shooter, she recognized his voice. She thought it was Jermaine. But that's not what she said in her first statement to police. She said she didn't know who the shooter was. And when she was threatened with accessory to murder, and when she was threatened with the loss of seeing her children, she said, okay, I think it's my brother Jermaine. That sort of encompasses the evidence, the strongest evidence the state had against Jermaine Brass.
So, Mr. Orm, can I focus you? You've got such little time and so many issues, I think what I'd like to hear specifically about is the Batson issue, and if you want to jump into that one.
Yes. Justice Perry-Gary, in this particular case, I would start with Juror Tracy Hereford. Juror Tracy Hereford was excluded. She was African-American. Two African-Americans were excluded by the state by peremptory challenges. Juror Hereford is interesting because what the state is arguing on appeal was their race-neutral reason was that she was a Democrat, and as a Democrat, she may have concerns about law enforcement. But it was completely belied by the record, and it was belied by analysis of other jurors.
Is it even proper to consider somebody's political registration in the context of a Batson challenge?
I would argue it is not.
Part of the jury questionnaire?
It was part of the jury
questionnaire. And that was one of the questions on the jury questionnaire. And you got together and put the questionnaire together, right?
Justice Perry-Gary, I was not trial counsel in this particular case, so I did not have
the
that involvement.
The counsel below got together with opposing counsel and you came up with one questionnaire?
Correct. But with regard to the political affiliation, one thing that I noted in that matter was that you have Juror Brislin, that's B-R-I-S-L-I-N, who admitted that she was the current director of the Anti-Defamation League. She was a Caucasian, or she was a non-minority, I should say. And in this particular case, the state didn't touch her, didn't do anything with her, didn't question her about that, didn't move to exclude her on that issue, but then uses the fact that here is an individual who is a Democrat, essentially a Democrat. And because she's a Democrat, we're worried about her opinions on law enforcement. They also point out that she was on a jury where a policeman was on trial for some type of drug allegation, and she was part of a jury that had found him not guilty. She said it was based on the facts. She said she could follow the law. She said that there was no difficulty whatsoever in her opinion following the law and giving each side a fair trial. So it seemed like it was...
Well, and that might be an argument to survive the for-cause challenge as opposed to the peremptory challenge. It was rehabilitated at some point. But going back to what we're to evaluate and analyze in Batson, the challenge...
It just seemed, Your Honor, that the argument being made was very, very simplistic and very easy to make. However, it did not when a comparison is made to the other jurors, it made no sense. And I have previously argued to this court that the state has continuously found reasons to exclude jurors that are pretextual. One I argued specifically a couple of years ago in front of this court is just asking someone if they know anybody who has had any negative involvement with law enforcement. African-American juror then says yes, and they're excluded. In this particular case, at the end of her questioning, one thing I thought was interesting was she was asked, have you ever had a bad traffic stop or any negative problem with law enforcement? She said no. But I thought, wasn't it an interesting question? Nobody else was asked anything like that. But if she had said yes, you know, once I was pulled over and I thought the man was mean, then they're going to use that. Okay, see, she asked.
One of the things that they focused on in this particular case was her prior jury service and how she was holed out for an acquittal in another case, and how she, I guess she had claimed that she is so persuasive in that regard. And I guess that would probably be a concern to counsel in this case. I can imagine it would be.
Justice Perry-Gary, she was asked that, were you the holdout? And one thing that she specifically said is she said You know, at first, yes, and it seemed like the transcript was reflecting some humor, but she said, in the end, no. In fact, it was based on facts. And it just seemed to me that I thought it was interesting that it was a police officer on trial. And so most of the time I would think that a lot of people who are, could be conservative would look at a police officer and give him or her more of a benefit of a doubt. And so she wasn't saying that she, essentially she turned them around, although it is in the record, Justice Perry-Gary, I'm not disputing that. Mm-hmm. However, I would argue that she was just simply part of a jury, and what they're doing is they're picking any argument that they can, including traffic stops, including being a Democrat. At this point, being a Democrat is enough, but it's not enough if you're the current director of the Anti-Defamation League. Then it matters.
Mr. Long, your time is getting away, but with the Batson, did you have issues as to the structural application of the Batson?
Yes, it was the manner in which the district court did not sufficiently consider the arguments. Batson objection was made. The court denied the Batson challenge. There was no consideration whatsoever for the arguments for what we're doing right here, and that is the consideration of was it pretextual. And it was made clear in the briefs that that is what we were arguing, that the structural error that had been outlined by this court specifically in Hawkins versus Nevada, a 2011 case where this court has said that the district court and defense should not fail to address pretextual reasons and more make specific findings as to why. That was not done in this particular case. Defense was not given an opportunity to do that. I realize that my time is...
Before you sit down, there are two other issues that we were concerned about. You can talk about one or the other. One was as to the denial of the alibi witness, and the other was as a kidnapping, hit one or the other, and give us your position.
I really enjoy both of those issues, and I wish I could address them both. I'll go with the alibi. The alibi, how can the court preclude the alibi? If you read or you hear the CDs of what the defendant talked to his wife about, or his girlfriend at the time, now his wife, he talked to her about what was going on in the trial. He did not address the substance of anything that she was going to say other than say he told her, tell the truth. Based on that, the state brings forth CDs of phone calls that he made from the Clark County Detention Center, and she is then simply precluded from testifying. He only had two witnesses. One was the alibi. And so to preclude him from putting on his alibi seems as a serious constitutional error in this particular case.
Doesn't the judge have an obligation to control his courtroom in the sense that he's, exclusionary rule was invoked, and you've got a defendant absolutely violating that rule and, in fact, making statements that I dare you to tape this, I dare you to... And that's something that Judge Smith seemed to really focus on, was the fact that he's daring him to do something about this, what Judge Smith saw as a wolf violation of that ruling.
Judge Smith did see it as a willful violation. However, even the defendant tried to speak and say, I didn't do anything really wrong. And defense counsel said it right, and consistent with U.S. Supreme Court case law, this court's cases, and the Ninth Circuit, and that is that there are lesser sanctions. One was hold the offending party in contempt. Two, let the state, we have a very, very seasoned prosecutor here, cross-examine the alibi witness over any violations, rather than just preclude her. And one thing that I'd ask the court to ask the state, what did he say? What did Jermaine Brass say on those phone calls that in any way told her what to say? Never does that happen. And in, I believe it's Trobert, it's a Ninth Circuit case or a U.S. Supreme Court case, where in that case, the defendant had gone to a witness and said, I testified to X, Y, and Z. Could you testify consistently? And the witness said, yes, he would testify consistently. That's something that could be articulated, not here. This was so important. The defendant had a right to a fair trial, a constitutional trial, and to put on that witness. With that, I see my time is almost done, and I would ask you to reserve the rest for rebuttal.
Thank you. Mr. Stanley?
Thank you. If I may accept counsel's invitation to begin by answering the question that he posed, the answer is replete in the record by the phone calls themselves. What he did, Justice Perogary, violates the core of the exclusionary rule in that he summarized. This was a conversation that took place over the weekend in a recorded jail phone conversation after the state's case in chief had been presented in its entirety. And in that phone conversation, multiple conversations, he outlined what every single witness testified to the state, not only to the core of what happened in the murder, but the events and the timing of witnesses and phone calls that occurred before and after the murder. It went right to the heart of establishing an alibi and who you could also controvert when you or contradict when you testify.
And I guess counsel's position is her testimony didn't change, or it wouldn't change, it would be consistent with her prior testimony.
Well, that's the claim now made on appeal, and counsel's interjecting a rule that no court in the federal or state system has ever adopted, that now, to violate the exclusionary rule, we must have a finding based on evidence that someone told the witness to lie or coach their testimony. But we do have, in this case, absolute evidence of coaching in the testimony. Specifically, Ebony Jones indicated in the phone calls that she was going to blurt out information that she knew would not be admissible based upon the joinder of the trial. And that was a strategy developed by her and or the defendant to specifically interject improper evidence in this case. My question that I wrote in my notes to this is, if not this case, what case? When you have in Torbert, the Ninth Circuit, that never analyzes what's the extent of the conversation that's improper, because no court has ever interjected that as a criteria in the formula to assess the sanction for violation of the exclusionary rule.
So you don't think in this particular case any lesser sanction could have been effective?
I think the court reviewed it, but based upon what it had, and two things, Justice Perogary, that I think leapt out to the court and what the law states. Number one is who's violating the exclusionary rule in the course of witnesses in a trial. This was done by the defendant himself, who was specifically admonished by the court on more than one occasion about the rule of exclusion. And number two, the content of what was said in this case went to the heart of what the exclusionary rule is designed to prevent. And that is an absolute discussion of all the witnesses that had testified in the trial prior to her attempting to take the stand. Not just one segment of the facts of this case, but the entire trial was laid out as to what the jury had heard by the defendant in these phone calls. As to the severance issue, let me just address a couple things. There is no allegation now, years after the trial, in the appellate briefs before this court, that any evidence presented during the trial violated Bruton. Not one. Counsel says that there's inferences that were drawn. Number one, what he cites to is a statement elicited by the state through Detective Jensen that Ronnie Brass stated, "We knocked on the door," which was immediately corrected in the defendant's original version saying, "I knocked on the door," that is referring to Ronnie's statement to the homicide detectives. Once again, it is a neutral pronoun as Bruton and its progeny embraces. Counsel says, in trying to dovetail their argument, that this was much like Duxworth in a circumstantial case, hoping to ring the bells to this court, alarming it about the nature and the quality of the evidence. I would simply highlight this. Jermaine and Ronnie Brass murdered Ernest Mitchell on the doorsteps in front of Ernest Mitchell's wife, that is Katrina Brass, the sister of Ronnie and Jermaine, an important and incredibly compelling fact in this case. Not only, as counsel says, she identified her brother Jermaine by voice, but she also identified him by several other critical factors that are completely absent from appellant's briefs. Number one, the voice. Number two, the complexion of the shooter. Number three, his height. Number four, his build. And that after the 10 shots that were struck the defendant, not one shot missed, justices, there were three execution shots to the back of Ernest's head. And after that, the shooter said, "Come on, Ronnie, let's go," calling his brother by name. And Ronnie, as the court remembers, I'm sure, from this, says, "You're going to have to shoot that, the B word, Katrina," using his sister's name, or first name, "and or she's going to tell on us too." Why would anybody have to say that, Ronnie, when Jermaine is masked up? And the answer is because she knew, as did Ronnie and Jermaine, that she knew her brother had just shot her husband. So there is overwhelming evidence about his guilt, and there's certainly nothing that violated the sanctity of the rule of Bruton. And finally, counsel says that the defenses were antagonistic. They may have been. I don't believe that matches the definition of antagonistic, but the more operative definition for severance is whether or not they were mutually exclusive. As that term is legally defined, the acceptance of one defense would reject the others, and as I'm sure your justices heard from counsel in his statements just to you, these are not mutually exclusive defenses. One is I'm not there, the other is I was there, but I wasn't the shooter, and I didn't commit a crime. As far as the Batson challenge, counsel cites it as an issue of the Democratic Party. It wasn't. What was clear both in the questionnaire and by this juror, that is juror Hereford, or potential juror Hereford's responses, was her compelling dialogue with the court, in some areas unsolicited, about her prior jury service, that she was the holdout and that she had convinced the other jurors to side with her and ultimately rendered a not guilty verdict in a criminal case. Now, counsel seems to indicate that the subject matter, that is a police officer, somehow renders that analysis different. I submit it doesn't, that indeed the race-neutral reason stands on all fours based upon her responses. And as far as the procedure that was utilized in the questioning of this juror, I asked the court to recall that this was based upon jury questionnaires. And so while counsel argues that the court did not give Jermaine and Ronnie's counsel time to address and develop the record regarding challenges for cause and peremptory challenges, the record was replete with evidence that supported the framework of the questions of the jurors. As all of the challenges made in appellant's brief reflect, those answers were given in the questionnaires themselves, or in the case of this Hereford, volunteered by her without any prompting by either the court or counsel in the case.
And Mr. Stanton, should political affiliation even be a subject matter for jury questionnaires or questioning during the voir dire process?
I would submit, Justice, that it's not. And in this particular case, as the record shows, the court directed counsel for the state and defense to get together prior to trial to agree on what areas of the questionnaire they could agree on. There were several that the state objected to. These types of, and I don't have a specific recollection of what we objected to, but it was these, this, what television shows you watch, other types of things that we, as the state, routinely object to, and I do, as they don't add anything to the process as to whether or not someone's qualified as a juror or not. But the question was in, that question was posed in several different categories, not only political affiliations, but whether or not you were affiliated with any organization such as the John Birch Society, the ACLU, Neighborhood Watch. Those are the questions that I guess presumably us trial lawyers think will ferret out what person's likes, interests, or so forth. But the political question, I think, is one that adds, in just a generic question, adds very little, if anything, to whether or not someone is a qualified juror.
Now, can you ask about religion, what somebody's religion is, other than can you vote for the death penalty or something, which would be a normal question, but is religion something that should be a fodder for jury selection?
I would think that it is, Judge, in the limited area that you're talking about, either on a question of the death penalty or, as I'm sure the court's aware of, the religious components of that they cannot, pursuant to their beliefs, sit in judgment of others. So there's a couple other areas that I think fall within the religious, moral, or philosophical category that are proper questionings. But from a generic sense, what religious beliefs do you hold, I think, is largely irrelevant.
With the Batson, you've been talking about part of the substance, but structurally, there's a concern reviewing this case, and it has nothing to do with the action of the state, but the action of the trial judge, and that is dismissing a juror prior to going through the exercise that's required by Batson.
Yes.
Because once the bell is rung, they're gone. He can't put them back.
I understand that. And there, in several of the trial count our courts in the 8th Judicial District Court handle these differently. They handle them in either an immediate sidebar or advise counsel they can develop the record later on. I agree with you that once they're excused, and in fact, let me just back up. One judge has those people still remain in the court, call somebody else, and then have them available so you don't run into the excused
and the court
quandary.
Understands that, but in this particular case, this particular judge, the record doesn't reflect that sidebar, so that at least their preliminary discussion could be had. The parties are dismissed, and then we go through the Batson exercise.
And I don't recall in this case, Justice, whether or not when cases like this occur, normally I and certainly frequently defense counsel seek to have that juror's questionnaire marked and made part of the record, because that develops, I think, a very significant, especially in this case, because all the inquiry were from comments that were made and developed repeatedly in their juror questionnaire.
But counsel, the problem for the court is that we have a juror that a Batson challenge is raised as to, the party is excused, the bell is rung before the record is created as to whether it's appropriate or not. Even though we may agree with you that it was a valid exclusion, the problem is, did we have a structural error?
I understand that, Justice. I would only indicate that while the structural error, as you framed it, with the slim record as it exists, I would submit that based upon the comments of the juror, of the particular juror in their questionnaire, is the record that made the judge's ruling rather swift, because it was, in this case, patently obvious to those that had heard her responses, both in the questionnaire and in response to it, that I think made his brevity in his decision to excuse the juror. That's my recollection of what had occurred. But I understand the predicament that this court has stated in this case, but and also other cases, but I think it's well satisfied by the record of the questionnaire itself. While counsel cited to address the court regarding the alibi witness, the other issue that was raised was the kidnapping. I asked our appellate staff to include, out of the multitude of exhibits that were admitted in this trial, to admit only two that speak to the issue of kidnapping. I understand, both at trial and on appeal, that this charge of kidnapping is not the normal kidnapping offense that this court sees. But in this case, when you are to look at the facts that this jury heard, the kidnapping falls on all fours on the inveigle theory of what was done with Ernest Mitchell. And the most compelling fact that I think is misstated in the appellant's brief is the dialogue that occurs between Ernest Mitchell and Ronnie. Ernest Mitchell was the size of an NFL linebacker. He was a very large, muscular man. He was a success story. He was a former gang member who, at the time of his murder, had turned his life around and was a licensed respiratory therapist. He was shot at nighttime while moving 10 times. Not one shot missed him. And during this interaction, Ronnie Brass, who couldn't have been taller than 5'6", and ironically has since been murdered in the Nevada State Prison past his conviction, came up to him and confronted him. Now, counsel says that Ronnie or Ernest was going to come out of that home no matter what, therefore there's not a kidnapping. But that's not the trial testimony. Katrina specifically outlaid that Ronnie Brass came up and began to confront. He wasn't there to apologize. And the two photographs that I asked to be admitted were the dynamics of where Ernest Mitchell was killed. He had nowhere to go once he came out of that home. He was boxed in by the structure of the house itself, and that's exactly what happened. Both Ronnie and Jermaine knew the home, knew the layout, knew exactly what they were doing by doing it at night and by coming up and confronting somebody who was already mad. His interaction and being unapologetic, and as the Katrina testified, raising his hands and backing up, challenging coming out, was tantamount to waving a red flag in front of a bull. And that's exactly what happened, and it was a coordinated effort to do it, not only by having him kind of out of the home, but as Katrina testified, giving a hand signal for Jermaine to come out and start shooting.
Mr. Stanton, before, I know your time is up, but before you sit down, I'll give you one more thing to enlighten us about. First, if you would talk about the law as a challenge to fight and whether that fits the scenario. And in the alternative, after you talk about that, if the court was to throw out challenge to fight and kidnap, would the murder for other reasons still stand?
I think it would, for the obvious reasons of the overwhelming evidence as it established to the other theories. The challenge to fight, I know this court has already addressed its constitutionality, and I would submit by not only the legislative history, but by the language of the statute itself, that the challenge to fight was designed in part to address exactly what occurred in this case. Situations where there is a plan, effort, and intent to commit death or bodily harm by that challenge. And in that context, it was an appropriate theory that is not constitutionally vague.
I guess the question, as opposed to the constitutional vagueness issue, is whether the evidence in this case supports that particular theory.
I think it does, Justice, because of the absolute uncontroverted testimony of Katrina with what Ronnie Brass did to lure Ernest out of the house and to engage him in a confrontation that he knew and had planned to be fatal. If that doesn't address what the law was designed to prevent, I'm not sure what does. Granted, there are other forms of challenges to fight that are commonly seen that lead to murder liability, but in this case, based upon these facts and what was the clear design and intent of both the defendants, I think
so
it fits on all
fours. So you're saying it's the circumstance as a whole as opposed to any particular words?
Correct, because the challenge to fight can't be viewed in context of merely just the challenge, but what was the plan and the intent that went with that challenge. And here, Ronnie Brass knew that if he challenged Ernest Mitchell to fight, it was going to be a one-punch fight. That was it. And so the design was not to challenge him in that context, but to engage him in a fight that was lethal for other reasons.
And
thank you.
And the last part, even if I know from the state standpoint, that theory and the kidnap theory stands up, but if the court would hold that the fight theory and the kidnap theory isn't appropriate, should this still hold?
It would. If your analysis then would be to strike the aspects of those theories, was there sufficient evidence viewed in the light most favorable to the state to support the remaining theories of liability? And I would submit both those theories were addressed by the nature of the facts itself and the uncontroverted testimony before the jury and to some extent on appeal before this court, and that they showed a conspiracy and a plan to aid and abet one another, and that the intent as they went over there was to indeed kill, evidenced by their conduct, the coordinated plan to get him from the home out of safety, and then of course 10 shots fired, 3 of them execution by people who are acting in concert with each other during the shooting itself.
There's no other questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Orr, we'll give you, Curtis giving you 3, let's make that 4.
Thank you very much. If I could address, first of all, the alibi. When I heard the state now tell this court that there was discussions on those jail calls about essentially what the alibi witness should say, it's completely inaccurate. And why I say it that way is because
I'm not sure I understood him as saying that in particular. I understood him to say there was a summary of what the other witnesses had testified to, and that's precisely what the exclusionary rule is designed to prevent, so that the witness who's been excluded can't craft their testimony around the other witnesses who have testified already.
That's absolutely accurate.
Okay.
However, that's not what occurs here. This is a husband and wife talking about a trial. It seems obvious that somebody would go home and say to their wife, this is what's happening, versus somebody who's saying, listen, witness X, Y, and Z says this, so you're going to have to craft your testimony. It was Jermaine Brass's argument that he was not present. The only thing his alibi could do is say, I know where he was. So it wasn't as though he was doing anything to craft her testimony. And in fact, the state asked this court to supplement their brief, and they were permitted to do so. And when I looked at it, they only claim 4 things that happened on those phone calls. The defendant told the alibi that family members were being excluded, and he thought that that was unfair. He said that once you testify, you get to stay in the courtroom. He then does say information about what some of the witnesses are saying against him, because it's a trial and he's on trial for murder. But the state never says, he tells the alibi, you know, you should probably say this or say that. He just says, tell the truth. And to preclude her just seems such a harsh reality and unconstitutional. The other things that I would like to address is with regard to it's not a normal kidnapping. I think that's what the prosecutor just told us. It's not a normal kidnapping. No, it's not a normal kidnapping. And here is the trial testimony. I've cited it in my brief. And this is Katrina Brass being questioned. And then Ernest saw it was Ronnie. What did he do? He just, you know, started yelling. And he went outside? Yeah. Did he go outside on his own free will? Yeah, he was going outside no matter what. I think that's what you testified to earlier. Yes. You weren't going to stop him from getting out that door. It's impossible to. He had his mind on going outside, so that's where he was going. Was he still mad? Very mad. Now I'm not quoting. He had just been attacking Katrina. He had kicked the kitchen cabinet door off hinges. He was choking her, and he was going outside. There was no challenge. It almost sounds like in every shooting, then there's a challenge to fight. Nobody ever
doesn't
said.
Doesn't that support counsel's position, his theory, that that's the only way they were going to get him is to get him outside and somehow move him from the protection of his home and get him outside? And to do that, he uses a challenge to fight. He's a great big guy, and he needs to get him outside in order to shoot him.
Justice Perry, very in the cases that I have cited, it seems very common in the cases that I've cited where people actually invade the home and then torture. And I believe in Mendoza and also in Pasqua, this court considered the fact that a person was taken inside their own home and tortured for 8 hours as evidence of kidnapping.
But in our definition, we get into inveigles or entices. Is that not a consideration?
It is a consideration, and it's something that this court specifically addressed in these prior cases. However, how is inveigling knocking on somebody's door when they're relatives, and then the man's furious, so he comes outside? The challenge to fight was not there. The kidnapping is not there. And this court said in Cortinas that if there's a harmless error analysis,
finish your statement.
There's a harmless error analysis, and when two of the valid or invalid theories of first-degree murder are improper, how can the court say beyond a reasonable doubt that Jermaine Brass was not unconstitutionally convicted? The only other two theories were lie in wait and premeditation, deliberation, and willful murder. I see that my time is done here.
Can I ask one more question?
I have two more questions. just
I'm going back. I have one concern, a primary concern here, as to the Batson issue and releasing that particular juror to whom the Batson challenge had been made before a hearing could take place. Is that happening commonly now in the district courts, and should we be terribly concerned about that?
I think you should be.
As Justice Douglas said, once they're gone, they're gone.
That's absolutely accurate, and when you say that, Justice Douglas, that is something that I have asked in capital cases that just judges do not do. Let me at least make the argument before you let the juror go. And in this particular case, the prosecutor may not remember, but I cite to it specifically in the reply brief at page 12. The state fails to discuss Jermaine's argument that Hereford, the juror, was dismissed by the court upon Jermaine's Batson motion being raised, and before the state was even required to give an explanation. So the district court judge just heard the Batson challenge and said, essentially, no, the challenge is good, and let the juror go. That is a real structural problem in this particular case. Have I answered your question, Justice?
Yes, thank you.
And Justice Gibbons?
Yeah, also on the Batson issue, Mr. Worm, I think if I understood Mr. Stanton correctly, he indicated that Juror Hereford kind of brought up this issue of her political affiliation. It wasn't something the state was delving into to excuse old Democrats from jury service. Then, what's your position on that?
Well, I cite to the record on that, and that is the reason the state is claiming that they released the particular juror, or they preempted the particular juror. So it's precisely that reason that reversal should be mandated in this particular case, because it's pretextual. And that was why I gave the comparison analysis that should be done to another juror who said that she was the director of the Anti-Defamation League, and they didn't seem to care at all. They used that as a pretextual reason to exclude that juror.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
The court thanks the parties on both sides for their arguments this day and the preparation of providing information to the court so we may make a decision as this matter. This matter will stand submitted.